Good morning. Today we're going to begin the section of Exodus that begins dealing with the priesthood. And I want to start today by reading a few verses from the book of Hebrews, chapter 5, and then we'll move into chapter 28 of the book of Exodus. Hebrews 5, 1. For every high priest taken from among men is appointed on behalf of men in things pertaining to God, in order to offer both gifts and sacrifices for sins. He can deal gently with the ignorant and the misguided, since he himself also is beset with weakness. And because of it, he is obligated to offer sacrifices for sins, as for the people, so also for himself. And no one takes the honor to himself, but receives it when he's called by God, even as Aaron was. So also Christ did not glorify himself so as to become a high priest, but he who said to him, "You are my son, today I've begotten you," just as he says also in another passage, "You are a priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek." In the days of his flesh, he offered up both prayers and supplications with loud crying and tears to the one able to save him from death, and he was heard because of his piety. Although he was a son, he learned obedience from the things which he suffered. And having been made perfect, he became to all those who obey him the source of eternal salvation, being designated by God as a high priest according to the order of Melchizedek. When an Israelite came to the tabernacle to worship, he would enter the tabernacle at the eastern gate with his sacrifice. It would be a male sheep or a goat. It could perhaps be a bull. It could be a pigeon. It could be a dove. He would enter the gate and he would walk as far as the bronze altar, perhaps 35 feet or so inside the gate. But when he reached the altar, he had gone as far as the law would allow him to go. There at the bronze altar, he would initiate the ritual sacrifice. He would place his hand on the head of the sacrificial animal, identifying himself with the innocent creature who's about to die in his place. Then he would cut the throat of the animal, and it would die at his feet. Beyond this point, it became the responsibility of the priest to carry out the tasks that were prescribed in the Mosaic law for this sacrifice. In this sense, the priest served as a mediator, as a representative of the people before their God. This role of priest was a great privilege. It was a great responsibility, and it also was dangerous. The slightest failure on the part of the priest in terms of preparation or performance would result in his death. We're conditioned to think that almost good enough is as good as good enough. It's the way we think as human beings. And most of the time, we can get away with thinking like this. But this is not the case when the issues are the holiness of God and the sinfulness of mankind. And the Lord wasted no time in making this point clear to Aaron and his sons. Through a tragedy, Aaron learned early that there was no room for compromise in the performance of his priestly duties. I want to take just a moment to look at something that I think will underscore this idea. If you glance at verse 1 of chapter 28 of Exodus, let's read this. It says, "Bring near to yourself Aaron, your brother." This is God addressing Moses. "Bring Aaron, your brother, and his sons with him from among the sons of Israel to minister as a priest to me. Aaron, Nadab, Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar, Aaron's sons." So we see here the names of Aaron's sons who are called to serve as priests before the Lord. They're Nadab, Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar. There's some things in life that truly do get your attention the first time you do them. And that's good in a lot of cases, because tension can focus our minds, so hopefully we don't make a mistake. One of the things I always remember when I think about this idea is the day that I first soloed in an airplane. I've never met a pilot who's forgotten the day that he first took the controls alone and as the poet said, slipped the surly bonds of earth and danced the skies on laughter-silvered wings. But I promise you, at that moment, you're not thinking about poetry. Usually, first-time challenges in life turn out just fine. And sometimes they don't. Apparently, a tragedy occurred the first day that the priesthood was in force. The tragedy is kept in record for us in Leviticus chapter 10. The first verse of Leviticus 10 says, "Now Nadab and Abihu," now you just saw them, these are two of the sons of Aaron, "Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, took their respective fire pans, and after putting fire in them, placed the incense on it," and then an odd phrase, "and offered strange fire before the Lord, which he had not commanded." I think from the way their names are listed back in Exodus, these are probably Aaron's first and second born son, the two older brothers. They were two men who had accompanied Moses and Aaron at least partway up Mount Sinai. Along with their younger brothers, Eleazar and Ithamar, they had been ordained as priests. And what a great day that must have been for Aaron and for the family. But that great day was soon shattered, as we'll see beginning in verse 2 of Leviticus 10. "And fire came down from the presence of the Lord and consumed them, and they died before the Lord. Then Moses said to Aaron, 'It's what the Lord spoke, saying, by those who come near me, I will be treated as holy, and before all the people, I will be honored.' So Aaron, therefore, kept silent." I'd love to know exactly what happened there. I'd like to know exactly what was meant by that phrase, strange fire. But we're not told. And maybe we're not told for a reason. Maybe the silence about this event teaches us more than we could learn from the specific event itself. And it's easy to let your imagination run a bit wild. Personally, I don't think that this was some sort of egregious moral failure on the part of these two young men. I really don't think it was a faith problem. I don't think it was an attitude problem. I think they were very pleased to be in the service of God as priests, and they probably wanted to do well. I can't imagine that they didn't. I can't imagine that they were just sitting there waiting for an opportunity to disobey God. Perhaps they made some small unintentional error. Maybe it was a failure in terms of proper preparation. Maybe something was askew of the instructions Moses had received for God. And I think perhaps the reason we're not told all the details about this is our attention might focus solely on that detail and miss the bigger picture. The bigger picture being that there's no room at all for error in the performance of the priest before the holy God of Israel. Whatever it was that disqualified their service before the Lord, they died. My point in deviating over to Leviticus in this passage is to emphasize that serving as a priest in the tabernacle of the Lord was very serious business, and it could not be approached with a laissez-faire attitude. For there is this sense in which even the priest was in a place where he was not qualified to be. And like Moses on Mount Sinai, when the priest stood in the temple or the tabernacle, the priest stood on holy ground. So when we read the details associated with priestly service, we're to understand that not even the smallest detail could be overlooked or shortchanged without dire consequences. So this is very serious business. Now, just as the worship of Israel required a sacred site, the tabernacle, it required sacred objects such as the ark and the mercy seat, the menorah, the golden table of the bread of the presence, the bronze altar, as well as the instruments that were used in the worship. It also required sacred personnel. And these sacred personnel were the priests. Priests act as mediators between God and Israel. And in this role, the way the priest is dressed and the preparations for the task that he's to perform were to a great extent symbolic. By these tasks that they did, by the way that they dressed, we're to understand that the priestly tasks were not ends unto themselves. This is not where the story was designed to end. But they were part of the tabernacle story that points forward to Christ and his intercession and mediation on behalf of believers in every dispensation. Primarily, the priests' responsibility were focused on two tasks. They were to teach the law of God to the people of Israel, and they were to facilitate the worship of God by performing certain liturgical tasks that were associated with his worship, specifically the offering of sacrifices and offerings made on behalf of the people to Yahweh. The Hebrew term that's translated priest is the word kohen. The verb from which it comes simply means to mediate spiritual things. And if you have any friends whose name is Cohen or Cone, C-O-H-N, somewhere in their family history, they have a link back to this priestly line, because that's what the word Cohen, as we would say it in English, or cone, means in Hebrew. Now, the next three chapters of Exodus are going to deal with various aspects of this Levitical priesthood. Chapter 28, the chapter we're going to be looking at today, details for us the special garments that the priests were required to wear. Chapter 29 will outline the purification process required of the priests. And chapter 30 deals with several other topics that are related to the priest's service, such as the altar of incense, the atonement money, the golden laver, and the anointing oil. So today we're going to look at chapter 28 and the priestly garments. Now, quite frankly, it's a chapter that's a bit long. It's a bit tedious. I thought about reading it to you with a Hebrew accent, and then I thought, well, that probably wouldn't keep them awake anyway. Plus, it would sound like a Texan reading with a Hebrew accent. But I do want to read chapter 28, so bear with me and let's look through this. It's a bit tedious. Bring near yourself Aaron, your brother, and his sons with him among the sons of Israel to minister to me as a priest. Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar, Aaron's sons. You shall make holy garments for Aaron, your brother, for glory and for beauty. You shall speak to all of the skillful persons whom I've endowed with the spirit of wisdom, that they make Aaron's garments to consecrate him, that he may minister as a priest to me. And these are the garments which they shall make: a breastpiece, and an ephod, and a robe, and a tunic of checkered work, a turban, and a sash. And they shall make holy garments for Aaron your brother and his sons, that they may minister as a priest to me. They shall take the gold, and the blue, and the purple, and the scarlet material, the fine linen. They shall also make the ephod of gold, of blue and purple and scarlet material, and fine twisted linen, the work of skillful workmen. It shall have two shoulder pieces joined at its two ends, that it may be joined. The skillfully woven band which is on it shall be like its workmanship, of the same material of gold, blue, purple, scarlet, fine twisted linen. You shall take two onyx stones and engrave on them the names of the sons of Israel, six of their names on the one stone, and the names of the remaining six on the other stone, according to their birth order. As a jeweler engraves a signet, you shall engrave the two stones according to the names of the sons of Israel, and you shall set them in filigrees. This is a word that simply means it's a jeweler's term, and it's just a meticulous setting into which a stone can be placed. These settings are to be of gold. You shall put the two stones on the shoulder piece of the ephod as stones of memorial for the sons of Israel, and Aaron shall bear their names before the Lord on his shoulders for a memorial. You shall make a setting of gold and two chains of pure gold, and you shall make them of twisted cordage, and you shall put the corded chains on the settings. You shall make a breastpiece of judgment, the work of a skillful workman, like the work of the ephod. You shall make it of gold and blue, purple, scarlet, and fine twisted linen. It shall be a square folded double, a span in length and a span in width. This is actually, interesting here. This is a perfect rectangle because, as he describes this, it is a square after it's been folded double. So its length is twice its width, and it is then folded, and you'll see why in a moment. So even though we translate this breast piece, what we're really talking about here is a sort of pouch that was on the front of the garb that the priest wore. Verse 17, you shall mount on it four rows of stones. The first row shall be of ruby, topaz, and emerald. The second row of turquoise, a sapphire, and a diamond. The third row, a jacinth, an agate, and amethyst. And the fourth row, a beryl, and an onyx, and a jasper. They shall be set in gold settings. The stones shall be according to the names of the sons of Israel, 12 according to their names. They shall be like the engravings of a seal, each according to his name, for the 12 tribes. You shall make on the breastpiece chains of twisted cordage work and pure gold. You shall make on the breastpiece two rings of gold, and shall put two rings on the two ends of the breastpiece. You shall put the two cords of gold on the two rings at the end of the breastpiece. And you shall put the other two ends of the cords on the two settings and put them on the shoulder piece of the ephod at the front of it. And I'm sure you've all got a perfect mental picture of this. You shall make two rings of gold and shall place each on two ends of the breastpiece on the edge of it, which is toward the inner side of the ephod. You shall make two rings of gold and put them on the bottom of the two shoulder pieces of the ephod on the front side of it, close to the place where it's joined above the skillfully woven band of the ephod. And they shall bind the breastpiece by its rings to the rings of the ephod with a blue cord, that it may be on the skillfully woven band of the ephod, and that the breastpiece may not come loose from the ephod. Aaron shall carry the names of the sons of Israel in the breastpiece of judgment over his heart when he enters the holy place for a memorial before the Lord continually. You shall put in the breastpiece. Notice here, I said the breastpiece is sort of a pouch. Here we see that something's going to go inside of it. So it was capable of carrying something. You shall put in the breastpiece of judgment the Urim and Thummim. That's how I've usually heard these words pronounced in English. Hebrew has a tendency to want to stress the final syllable. So in Hebrew, this would really be the Urim and the Thummim. But I think that sounds kind of strange. So I'm going to say it the way I've always heard it. Urim and Thummim. They shall be over Aaron's heart when he goes before the Lord, and Aaron shall carry the judgment of the sons of Israel over his heart before the Lord continually. You shall make the robe of the ephod all blue. There shall be an opening at the top in the middle of it. Around its opening there shall be a binding of wooden work, or woven work, like the opening of a coat of mail, so that it will not be torn. I think it's kind of interesting here. It doesn't really say in the text that this is made of one piece of cloth, but I wonder sometimes if the emphasis on the robe that Jesus wore the day of the crucifixion, there's a big stress in that story in the New Testament that it was one piece and that they cast lots for it so as to not tear it, which I assume would mean along the seams, which they might have done. And I just wonder if perhaps they knew that the priest of the high priest's robe was one piece as well, and that there may be some connection there. I can't prove that, but it's an interesting thought. Verse 33. You shall make on its hem pomegranates of blue and purple and scarlet material, and all around its hem bells of gold between them all around. A golden bell and a pomegranate, a golden bell and a pomegranate all around the hem of the robe. It shall be on Aaron when he ministers, that his ringing may be heard when he enters and leaves the holy place before the Lord, that he may not die. You shall also make a plate of pure gold, and you shall engrave on it, like the engravings of a seal, holy to the Lord. The word here is really not plate. It's a word that literally means a shiny thing. And it's some sort of medallion or diadem sort of something that would be attached to the turban or the headpiece, facing forward, on which you could inscribe an inscription. 37. You shall fasten it on a blue cord, and it shall be on the turban. It shall be at the front of the turban. It shall be on Aaron's forehead, and Aaron shall take away the iniquity of the holy things which the son of Israel consecrate with regard to all their holy gifts, and it shall always be on his forehead, that they may be accepted before the Lord. You shall weave the tunic of checkered work of fine linen, and shall make a turban of fine linen. And you shall make a sash, the work of a weaver. For Aaron's sons you shall make tunics. You shall also make sashes for them, as you shall make caps for them for glory and for beauty. You shall put them on Aaron your brother and on his sons with them. You shall anoint them and ordain them and consecrate them that they may serve me as priests. You shall make for them linen breeches to cover their bare flesh. They shall reach from the loins even to the thighs. They shall be on Aaron and on his sons when they enter the tent of meeting, when they approach the altar to minister in the holy place, so that they do not incur guilt and die. It shall be a statute forever to him, to his descendants after him. It's a bit tedious, isn't it? It's hard to get a grasp, really, of what this looks like. God commands Moses to appoint Aaron and his sons to the priesthood, and he does this in such a way that we're able to understand that these men were not elected to this post, to this position. They were not chosen by Moses. They were chosen by Yahweh. They were appointed by him, and through the agency of Moses, they received this call. There's a purpose behind the calling to priesthood, and that is so that they may minister to me, that is to God, as priests. This phrase occurs three times in the first four verses, chapters. In chapter 28, it's in verse 1, verse 3, and verse 4. And undoubtedly, this repetition, and it's a word-for-word repetition, is for emphasis. Following the command, bring these men near, which is, that is, to select them for service, God instructs Moses regarding the priestly attire, which they're to wear. And in verse 3, Moses is told to seek out skillful people to make these garments. The Hebrew text refers to these people as wise of heart. The Hebrew word for wisdom is chokmah, and it means to have a masterful understanding of something, to have a skill. Here it refers to someone with the skill of an artisan. I wish we had more time to talk about biblical wisdom. It's a fascinating concept, but we don't. I'll simply say that biblical wisdom cannot be separated from knowledge, but it's more than knowledge. Pilots fly airplanes because they have a certain knowledge of aerodynamic theory, but wise pilots know when to stay on the ground. I remember a few years ago, two friends and I flew down to Rockport to go fishing. I had a beach craft, and my friend and I took off from Addison one morning about 4:30 in the morning, and we flew down to, remember, Mueller Field in Austin. Landed in Austin and picked up my friend's little brother, who was a student at UT. We flew down to Rockport, and we fished for a few days. The weather was beautiful. We were flying back to Austin to drop off Bruce, the little brother. The weather kept getting worse and worse, and the only way I can describe this is it was a lot like a wedge. When we took off in Rockport, blue skies. Then we got under an overcast, and as we came in toward Austin, this overcast began to get lower and lower and lower, so that rather than going in the clouds, I continually had to descend. And I got down to the point where I was making eye contact with cows. I told my friends, I said, I can no longer pick up any of the navigation signals from Mueller because we're too low. I'm making eye contact with cows. I think it's going to start raining. We're either going to have to turn around and try to get back to Victoria, or we're going to be landing over here in one of these fields because it's too dangerous to go on. About the time I got that out of my mouth and looked over at their faces, which were pictures of stark terror, flying's been called hours and hours of boredom, accentuated by brief moments of stark terror. And I looked at them, and just as I looked at them and kind of got that feedback, Mueller came on the radio with the wonderful words I'd been hoping to hear. He said, 2227 X-ray, radar contact. And he gave me a vector, even though we were only a few hundred feet off the ground. He vectored me into Mueller, and I landed. We went into the FBO there, and after being in there for a few minutes, I was looking at the radar trying to decide whether I could slip around this cloud or slip around that way and get back to Dallas. Three Air Force guys walked in. Two of them had gray hair, all three sporting USAF wings on their chest. So I figured they know what they're doing. So I struck up a conversation with one of them, and I think it didn't take him very long to figure out that I was not yet that wise pilot that I mentioned earlier, because he called me Sonny. He just kind of went like this. He said, I know where you're going. I was trying to decide whether to go take off again. Sonny, you're as far off the ground as you need to be today. That's the example, I guess, between knowledge and wisdom. But biblical wisdom actually goes a little bit beyond this, because it's not just wisdom that's based on experience. It's a gift of God, and we're asked as believers to pray for wisdom. The book of Proverbs is considered a book of wisdom, and it is. But a person could memorize the book of Proverbs and still lack biblical wisdom if his heart was not changed by what he gained from this study. These artisans were endowed by God with a special skill, a special wisdom, and they were chosen for this. This fact alone should inform us of the significance and the importance placed on the spiritual truth that was symbolized by the attire of the priests. The focus on chapter 28, as I mentioned, is on the ceremonial dress of the high priest. In its style, in its colors, in its implements, Aaron became typically what Jesus Christ is intrinsically. Verse 4 itemizes the main features of the priest's clothing. There's a breastpiece. There's something called an ephod. There's a robe. There's an engraved plate of some sort made of pure gold. It's actually mentioned down in verse 36. This plate was fashioned to a turban or a headpiece. Then there was a tunic, and there was a ceremonial sash. The materials from which these are made are strikingly identical, actually, to those used in the sanctuary. Gold, purple linen, blue, scarlet, white, all the things that were used in the curtains and the veil of the tabernacle. By now, this consistency shouldn't surprise us, and the symbolism is something we should be familiar with by now. The first two items that are mentioned are the breastpiece, which is actually, as I mentioned, a kind of pouch, and then something called an ephod. The breastpiece is the first item mentioned back in verse 4, which in the style of Hebrew writing means that it was considered the more important of the two. But when the detailed descriptions are given, it's the ephod that's described first in verse 6, since it becomes the backdrop for this pouch or breastpiece. The breastpiece, we'll see in a moment, is attached to the ephod. What on earth is an ephod? It's actually pronounced aphid in Hebrew, but that sounds like an insect to me, so I've chosen to use the English pronunciation here. If you're asking, what is an ephod? Because it doesn't seem to match anything that you are aware of in English, you'd be correct. Ephod is really a transliterated Hebrew word. To transliterate something means you take the Hebrew word and you write it in English characters rather than translating it into an English word. So when you see the word ephod, you're actually looking at a Hebrew word written in English characters, and that's why it doesn't seem to correspond to anything that you might know. It was made of fine linen with gold and blue, purple, and scarlet thread. It was a piece of clothing that was worn around the pelvic area, sort of like an apron or perhaps like a pinafore. Is that a female term only? If you can picture, well, the women now know exactly what this looks like. The guys are going, a pinafore. That's no easier for me to picture than an ephod. Think of it as a type of apron. I'm skeptical of this picture. I'm skeptical because if you look over his left shoulder, there's a Christian flag and a cross. So I'm not sure what this guy is. I've been looking at this picture all week. I nicknamed him Joe. The part of the clothing here that he's wearing that would correspond to the ephod would be this part right here. This is the breastplate. Whether the top of this ephod is up here around the neck or somewhere around the waist or someplace in between, I don't know. But it is in effect an apron-like device that fits around the pelvic area. That's exactly what the word actually means. This is another picture, and here you'll see that the word ephod is actually written here for us, so we can't make a mistake, and it points again to this bottom part. It points to this bottom part of the attire. It was made of two parts, one to cover the front, one to cover the back, and then these two parts were connected to one another by shoulder straps, which you can see over the shoulder there. To the shoulder straps, the top of the shoulder, were two onyx stones which were engraved with the names of the Israelite tribes, and they were attached to the shoulder straps of the ephod. I want you to notice that if they were sitting on top of the shoulder, these names of the tribes of Israel were always pointing upward. And there were six tribe names per onyx stone, two onyx stones, one per shoulder. And you can see these say Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, and Joseph. The other six would have been on the other shoulder. Every time the priest ministered in the sanctuary, he bore the names of the tribes whom he represented before God. In this manner, because of the inscription of these tribes, in this manner, they're always facing upwards when the priest is serving before God's presence. And as such, they're always before this is symbolic. They're always before the face of God, which is a way of emphasizing that God will never forsake Israel and that his covenant promises are eternal. The ephod, with its colors and materials, typify Christ as the great high priest. As the high priest, Christ bears his people on his shoulders, the place of strength, the seat of power. The shoulders also speak of bearing a burden. Christ bore the burden of sin, and it is Isaiah the prophet who said, "You have burdened me with your sins. You've wearied me with your iniquities." So it was to this ephod that the breastpiece was attached. The next item mentioned is the breastpiece itself, this pouch. The discussion of the ephod actually ends at verse 12, and then the breast piece is described beginning verse 15. And in between, there are two verses that deal with the settings and the gold chains that attach the two pieces together. Two chains were to be constructed of pure gold and fitted into settings, apparently some sort of gold rings to which these items could be attached. So the gold chains and then these rings or the settings bind the breastpiece to the ephod. The breastpiece is known as a hoshen. What's this? Well, it's defined for us as the breastpiece of judgment. And it's judgment in the sense of a decision, not in the sense of wrath. The breastpiece of judgment. According to verse 15, it was designed to match the ephod in terms of craftsmanship, materials, and in its appearance. In fact, this item was worn on the breast of the high priest as a pouch. And you'll notice in verse 16 that it shall be square when folded. So once again, this is a perfect rectangle folded into a pouch, a span in length and a span in width, the text says. And then in verse 30, it says, "You shall put into the breastpiece of judgment the Urim and the Thummim." So it was a pouch into which these things could be placed and carried about by the priest. Golden chains attached to the onyx clasps on the shoulders bound the ephod together and held it in place. In addition to holding these things called the Urim and Thummim in its pouch, the breastpiece was designed with sort of a gold frame which included sockets into which you could fit precious stones. And it was four rows of stones, three stones per row. That's another possibility of the way the onyx stones would have looked with the engravings. The 12 tribes are listed differently, different places in the Old Testament. And the way this is done here is it lists Joseph. Sometimes Levi's, if Levi's not included, then it'll say Ephraim and Manasseh. If Levi's in there, which the focus here is certainly on the priesthood, Levi's going to be there, then sometimes Joseph is used. so that you still have 12, but there's not a consistency throughout the Old Testament of how the 12 tribes are designated. What's wrong with this picture? The fact that this says Hoshen probably indicates that's the top of the picture. They have three rows of four, and it should be four rows of three. This is a more proper designation. This is one possibility of how these might have looked, and you can see the inscriptions. And again, this says Joseph. So that's how they're doing it. Here's another possible configuration of this breast piece. You can see the onyx stone at the top, which would be up on the shoulder, and the golden chains and the settings, and then the pouch, which is attached at the top to the onyx stones and then at the bottom to the ephod. Probably is significant that these onyx stones facing upward to God are stressing the position that Israel holds in the heart of God, or in the sight of God. These stones which have the tribes written are facing out to the people. This breast piece would have held these sort of mystical items called the Urim and Thummim, and you have to ask what these things are. Well, I can tell you what the words mean, but I can't tell you a lot more than that because we're not told a lot more than that. Urim probably comes from the Hebrew word or, which means light. So this word has an I-M ending on it, you'll see. I-M is plural in Hebrew. So this is a word that comes from the word light, and it's plural, so it probably means lights. Urim was also used to refer to the east, which was the source of light or a region of light focused on the idea of the dawn. There are some who have tried to tie this word to a different Hebrew root, which means to curse, but I don't think that makes any sense at all in this context. So we're going to go with the idea of lights or light, depending on how you interpret the plural. Thummim comes from the word tamim, which means perfection. It's also plural, as you'll see by the I-M ending, so it means perfections, plural. So the Urim and Thummim means lights and perfections. Now that doesn't really tell us a lot about how it was used or how it worked or what it did. The fundamental question that is always associated with this is how can Israel know God's will? And keep in mind that this is a time when there's not a body of revelation floating around that the people can read. So the question of how to know and understand and perform God's will is a serious question. Now, the Bible always forbids divination. It never approves of any association with the occult in any form or fashion. So this has to be different from that because God has sanctioned these things for Israel. This was a decision-making device of some sort whereby on certain occasions, not always, but on certain occasions and in with respect to certain questions and certain contexts, the priest could determine God's will. If you look through the Old Testament, you'll find David, for example, inquiring, and I'm sure it was through this process, shall we go up and fight this enemy? And God says, go up, or don't go up. And this was the device the priest is using to determine the will of God at this point. So there were very physical things that were used for the determination of God's will. If you look at what Jewish historians and rabbis say about this, they typically think that we had two jewels or two stones, one black and one white. Now, it doesn't say black or white in the text, but most of the Jewish commentators think one was black and one was white, and that the one on the left, the white one, indicated a no answer, and the one on the Thummim indicated a yes answer. And whether they threw them or some people have said they thought they gave off a light, I don't necessarily believe that. They were somehow used to determine by the priest what the will of God was in certain but not all situations. So these were kept in this breastplate of judgment. And the reason it's called a breastplate of judgment is because of the decisions that were made based on what was in it. It's not the breastplate of judgment in the sense of wrath, but the breastplate of decisions or judgments that were made based on these stones or jewels or whatever they were that was kept inside the breastplate. The Old Testament seems to indicate that the Urim and Thummim faded with use during the early period of the monarchy. In fact, there's only one mention of them after the Babylonian captivity, and that is in the second chapter of Ezra, verse 36. That's the last reference chronologically in the Bible, and by that time they had more or less fallen out of use. And it makes sense to me, to try to sum this up, that as God began to deal with Israel and to speak to Israel through the prophets, and as the body of written revelation began to develop, that the need for this type of a thing and their significance would fall out of favor and would be unnecessary. And I think that's exactly what happened. I think this was a way that God communicated his will through the priests at a certain period in time, and then the need for it simply fell away as the prophets began to be more active in their communication of God's will to the people. There was no need to go back to this type of thing. The fourth paragraph is verses 31 through 35, and it talks there about the robe of the ephod. And the reason it's called that is that it was worn beneath this ephod. So that beneath the ephod there was a blue robe that was worn by the priest. Here's our guy again, wearing a blue robe. Golden bells and pomegranates were alternated around the hem, and that's what you see down in the white part at the bottom in this picture. This was a sleeveless robe, and it was worn beneath the ephod, probably extending below it. And it's interesting because most of the time when you see this used, you're dealing with yes or no questions. Should I go up or should I not go? Should I engage in battle or should I not engage in battle? But there are occasions, and I didn't write a reference down, but there are occasions where there's more information communicated than yes or no. If you really do a study of this, you will find occasions where this was used to communicate more than a yes or no answer. Theories are not lacking in how this worked. There are, I suppose, the sort of the most out there theory that I read about is that through the two stones or whatever were in the pouch plus the 12 that are on the chest of the priest, which have words on them, and then you've got two stones up here, that the Shekinah glory actually caused them to flash in sequence. The problem is if you've got 12 plus 2 on the shoulder plus 2 more, that's 16. There are 22 characters in the Hebrew alphabet, so I don't know how you account for that. I think it's ridiculous myself, but I did spend a little bit of time reading about this. So, this robe has bells on it. I don't think the intent of the bells was to tell us whether the priest had died. That's one of the theories of them. I think that if you have a bell on you that rings when you walk, you're going to be a little more conscious of entering the tabernacle with reverence. You're going to be entering the tabernacle with, in effect, an announcement that you're coming. And I think it may simply have contributed to a couple of things. One, the reverence with which the priest approached his task, that he was not to be jostling around, making as much noise as he could possibly make. And it also would have been, I think, a comforting sound to the people who would know that the priest was acting on their behalf in the role that he's been called to perform. I think that's probably the reason. Then there is this engraved plate. It's called a sitz. It really means a shiny thing. And you can see that this shiny thing looks like a crown. I don't know that that's what this looked like. This is someone's idea. And it has an inscription on it that says, "Holy to the Lord." Here's another possible look at what it may have looked like. In this case, it looks more like a band. It served, in a sense, as a crown. It's actually referred to as the Holy Crown in chapter 29, verse 6. So it had some semblance of a crown to it. It was attached to the headpiece by a blue ribbon. I believe that we would probably call this headpiece a turban. And it was inscribed with this inscription, Kodesh Ladonai. This is the word for holy. This is the preposition to, And then these four characters here are the word Yahweh. So this inscription that was on there was Kodesh LeAdonai, is how they would say it. Holy to the Lord. Holy is the idea of separation, being set apart for a particular task. And in this case, it's not just the priest, but it's Israel, those whom the priest represents, who are set apart. Any iniquity or guilt would be made obvious to the person when considering this particular inscription. It was a constant reminder that Israel was to be a kingdom of priests, holy to the Lord, and that our acceptance as a forgiven people was purely an act of grace. This engraving is the third engraving that we've seen associated with these garments. We have the onyx stones, which are engraved. We have the stones on the breastplate, which are engraved. This is the third engraving that we see here. It's an intentional way of emphasizing the importance and the permanence of what's written. Namely, that the tribes of Israel are Yahweh's permanent possession, and that there is an absolute requirement for holiness in the presence of God. The priest represents these tribes every time he performs his priestly duties in the tabernacle. He is their representative. He carries their names as a written word on his chest, over his heart. And the proclamation is on his head, holy to the Lord, a declaration that he and those he represents, as well as the services that he performs, are holy unto the Lord. There is then a tunic and a sash. These are commissioned not only for Aaron, but for Aaron's sons. Aaron is to wear this tunic beneath his robe, but Aaron's sons, as the priests, were a little bit less formal than the high priest, and so they wore the tunic as an outer garment, and their turban wasn't as fancy as his, I guess you could say. The final element to these pieces of clothing are what are called linen drawers that were worn, according to verse 42, to cover his bare flesh. I mentioned early on that some of the Canaanite priests who will soon enough be encountered by these Jews as they come into Israel did a lot of their pagan ceremonies unclothed. And this was not going to be the case for the priests of Israel. So I think one of the why he stresses here that it was to cover his bare flesh is to set apart the priests of Israel from the Canaanite priests whom they will encounter when they enter the land. When you think about these garments, I want you to think of them as the external sign of the priesthood. Moses is enjoined to fashion these symbols in the form of vestments for Aaron and his sons, who are then ordained, which is really just a way of saying charged with the duties of the office of priest. There's also a responsibility assumed on the part of the ones the priest serves. The Hebrew phrase that's translated ordained literally is, you shall fill their hands. You shall fill their hands. It's an indication that it is your responsibility as the Israelites who are represented by these priests to provide them whatever they need for the service that they provide both to God and to you. When the priest is dressed in these garments, he's indicating that he is the representative of the 12 tribes of Israel before the God of Israel. The rigorous ritual, the intricate fashioning of these clothes, in and of themselves don't accomplish anything. In this case, the clothes do not make the man, but they point to the man who will come ultimately and be appointed to a better priesthood than the priesthood of Aaron. On the 2 weeks from now, which will be the next time I teach, we will take up the idea of the priest's consecration and preparation for service in chapter 29.